One of the key pieces of this was not just to, you know, lay a lot of people off, to kill certain departments or significantly reduce the capacities of others, but also to ensure that what comes out on the other side of this is much more beneficial to Elon Musk specifically and some parts of the tech industry more broadly, with the rollout of Starlink in many different agencies, the gutting of regulators who were looking into Elon Musk's businesses. And we see that, you know, a section of the tech industry wants to really see a remaking of not just the aerospace industry, but military procurement as well. And I think that we're starting to see changes in that space too. So it has been a really significant 100 days. Obviously, there's talk now about whether Elon Musk is going to continue. He's talked about reducing the amount of time he spends there to 2 days a week. But even then, 2 days a week is quite a lot of time to cause a lot of havoc.
And this issue of Musk's Doge is not just centered in the United States per se. You've reported, for instance, that several Canadian tech executives recently launched the initiative Build Canada. The website lists that's its goals, building more pipelines, firing over 100,000 federal workers in Canada, and increasing immigration restrictions. What do you see as the possibility of this approach of dismantling the liberal democratic state going global?
Yeah, so I think it is a serious worry, right? We often see things that happen, say, in the United States, eventually get exported to other parts of the world. And I would not be surprised if something, if there's not a push from the political right in other countries to try to do something similar with a Doge organization, kind of wrapping it in this, you know, kind of cloak of efficiency and you know, the use of technology and things like that, but actually allowing this further gutting of the state based on what we've seen over the past number of decades. Already, right? And so in Canada, we have seen tech executives explicitly say that they want to see a Doge. It's interesting, actually, the head of Build Canada in the past few weeks came out and said, no, our goal is not to build a Doge, recognizing how, you know, that term and that notion had been so toxified based on what was happening in the United States. But that didn't also stop, a number of prominent conservatives at a recent conservative conference in Canada to actually talk about how it would be easier to roll out a Doge in Canada. And there was even an executive from Amazon there, a senior public policy person, who was explaining how Amazon and other cloud services could be used to collect a lot of data on government that would aid in this process of deciding which parts of the government, which programs should be eliminated, which I think is, you know, a very worrying relationship to see, not just with these Canadian tech executives, but people from, you know, a major company like Amazon being part of these conversations in Canada probably shows that, you know, still how close this relationship between parts of the tech industry and, the right wing are, especially when it comes to these efforts.
Paris Marks, I want to thank you for being with us, host of the podcast Tech Won't Save Us. We'll link to your latest article and your newsletter, Disconnect, Canada's Tech Executives Aren't Scared of Mark Carney. And we'll link to your four-part podcast, Elon Musk Unmasked. Next up, today is the 50th anniversary of the end of the Vietnam War. We'll speak to the Pulitzer Prize-winning Vietnamese-American writer Viet Thanh Nguyen about Vietnam, Trump's first 100 days, and more. Stay with us.
Sad scenes of destruction on every hand. Black waters rise sweet time in the roots of tall timber, she nests with her young. When the hillside explodes and the dynamites roar, the voice of the small bird is heard there no more. And the mountain comes sliding so awful and grand.
Blackwater's folk musicians Nora Brown and Stephanie Coleman performing in our Democracy Now! Studio. They joined us in March to talk about their recent appearance at the Kennedy Center, where they unfurled banners to protest President Trump's takeover of the famed cultural institution. They played at the Kennedy Center the night that the vice president, Vice President Vance, was booed there. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Today marks 50 years since the Vietnam War ended. On April 30th, 1975, North Vietnamese tanks smashed through the gates of the presidential palace in the South Vietnamese capital of Saigon. Communist soldiers hoisted their flag atop the building. Video of U.S. personnel being airlifted out of Saigon was broadcast around the world. Some 3 million Vietnamese people were killed in the U.S. war, along with about 58,000 U.S. soldiers. Hundreds of thousands of Lao, Hmong, and Cambodians were also killed. The impact of the war is still being felt in Vietnam and the region. Earlier today, events were held in Ho Chi Minh City, the former Saigon, to mark this 50th anniversary of Vietnam's victory over the United States. This is Tho Lam, the General Secretary of the Communist Party of Vietnam.
After 50 years of national reunification and nearly 40 years of reform, Vietnam has overcome a multitude of difficulties and challenges to achieve immense triumphs of historic significance, building for ourselves the fortune, the power, the international standing and prestige that we enjoy today. From a poor, backward country ravaged by war under embargo and isolation, today Vietnam has become a developing country, approaching upper middle income that is deeply integrated into international politics, the global economy, and the civilization of humankind.
We're joined now in Pasadena, California, by Viet Thanh Nguyen, the Pulitzer Prize-winning author of several books, including most recently, To Save and to Destroy, Writing as an Other. His co-edited collection is also just out, titled The Cleaving, Vietnamese Writers in the Diaspora. Viet Thanh Nguyen was born in Vietnam in 1971, fled the country with his family in 1975. In an op-ed in the Los Angeles Times, he writes, quote, "Most American presidents have learned the wrong lessons from the American War in Vietnam, as it is called there." Viet Thanh Nguyen, welcome back to Democracy Now! It's so good to have you with us. I'm wondering if you can talk about what those wrong lessons are, especially in light of the Trump administration angering Vietnam veterans, those in Vietnam as well, banning senior American diplomats from attending events on this 50th anniversary of the end of the war in Vietnam, and then, because of outcry, reversing themselves. But tell us what you think the lessons are and the lessons that we in the United States learn wrong.
Thanks for having me, Amy. I think the lessons or the mistakes that American presidents have made started with Woodrow Wilson in 1919, refusing to listen to the appeal of a very young Ho Chi Minh in Paris who had come to ask for American recognition of the Vietnamese quest for independence. And from that mistake, we've had a series of mistakes over the past century, mostly revolving around the fact that the United States did not recognize Vietnamese self-determination. The United States meddled in Vietnamese affairs, sided with the French in terms of their colonization, took over the French efforts after the French were defeated by Ho Chi Minh in 1954. If the United States had not interfered, I think the outcome in the long term would have been pretty much exactly the same, with Vietnam turning into a capitalist economy, which it pretty much is now, and the United States relying on Vietnam as an ally against China. The difference would have been that if the United States had not intervened, at least 3 million Vietnamese people wouldn't have died, and hundreds of thousands of Lao, Hmong, and Cambodians, as you pointed out. Now, the tradition of American presidents towards Vietnam has also included a use of soft power. We've relied on our cultural arm and our aid programs and the rhetoric of American democracy to try to pull Vietnam closer to us and to justify our intervention into Vietnam. Trump is not a quiet American like his predecessors. He's an ugly American. He doesn't believe in soft power. He believes purely in the exercise of American hard power. And we're seeing some of those consequences in many areas, but certainly in Vietnam, where he's trying to engage in a trade war or raise tariffs to a very high level, but also, as you've just mentioned, refusing to participate, at least until yesterday, in something as basic as a commemoration of a difficult and shared history.
And Viet Thanh Nguyen, yet the United States, not too long after the war ended, began fixing its relationships with Vietnam, and up until recently has engaged in major trade with Vietnam. Unlike, for instance, U.S. policy toward Cuba, which it never fought a war with, but it continues to isolate to embargo.
I think there's a big strategic difference between Vietnam and Cuba. Vietnam still matters a great deal in terms of the politics of the region of Southeast Asia, especially with China right to the north. Vietnam and China have always had an extremely difficult relationship ever since China colonized Vietnam for 1,000 years. Vietnam considers China its major rival, influence, threat, and so on, which means that it's willing to let bygones be bygones with the United States and wants to engage in a relationship with the United States, whereby it could use American military and political aid to be a counterweight against China. And the United States also recognizes Vietnam's potential in that way. I don't think Cuba has the same strategic advantage as it does, as Vietnam does for the United States. And Cuba has the problem of a very large, very vocal, very conservative Cuban-American population that has tremendous influence on American politics. Vietnamese-Americans are also deeply anti-communist for the most part, but they don't have the same political ability to manipulate or influence American foreign policy.
Yeah, and you've written, quote, American interventions haunt the United States. President Reagan saw Central America as the next front of the Cold War after the war in Vietnam. Could you talk about the impact of the American loss in the war in Vietnam toward foreign policy in the years after that?
Well, the war in Vietnam was obviously extremely divisive internally for the United States, and it was also a war that was a complete defeat for the United States. So a complete shock in so many ways for a United States that in the 1950s and 1960s saw itself as the ascendant global power. So the setback in terms of American military power, political power, prestige, self-confidence after 1975 was quite tremendous. American presidents on both the Democratic and Republican sides set out immediately to try to rehabilitate American power. And the fears that had led to U.S. involvement in Vietnam and Cambodia and Laos were still there. So in 1983, Ronald Reagan gave a speech about Central America in which he declared that this was the new front of the Cold War. Nicaragua had been lost, supposedly, to the Sandinistas. And now this posed a threat to El Salvador. And he names El Salvador specifically as the first country where this Cold War would again be waged. This set the stage for our own current political climate today, because the war in Central America, especially in El Salvador, that the United States supported, was brutal. Thousands of Salvadorans were killed at the hands of a Salvadoran military that had been trained by the United States. Numerous atrocities were committed. Many people fled northwards to the United States as refugees. Some of them became gangsters. Some of them were deported, beginning in the Clinton administration, back to El Salvador, where they fomented or helped to become a part of a very serious gang problem with tremendous amounts of violence. This created the opportunity for President Nayib Bukele in 2022 to declare a state of exception that allowed him to put 80,000 people into his prisons without due process, alleged gang members, many of whom were actually not gang members. I was in San Salvador in February on the very same day that Marco Rubio was in town to sign the agreement with President Bukele to use El Salvadoran prisons to hold deportees or rendition people from the United States in prisons that were built there directly as a consequence of this long chain of history that went from Vietnam to El Salvador and now to a deportation prison.
You have said, Viet Thanh Nguyen, that El Salvador is Spanish for Vietnam. If you can explain that and also go on to talk about the U.S., especially right now, though you can give us some history, which is so important in all of your work, the U.S. attitude toward immigrants. You write in your Time magazine piece that it is now, with the Trump administration weaponizing the fear of the other and promoting a moral panic about strangers coming to our shores, when these people, including those who are also Americans, become seen as a threat to the nation, they are no longer a part of us. Instead, they become the other to our collective self as a country. Take it from there, Viet.
Sure. First of all, with Vietnam's El Salvador is Spanish for Vietnam, that was actually a slogan of the Western left during the 1980s. The same Western left that had organized against the American war in Vietnam saw enormous similarities with what was happening in El Salvador. So that became a global rallying cry in opposition to this renewed campaign of American power in another poor country in which the civilians would bear the brunt of American foreign policy. Now, when it comes to the other, I'm quite familiar with that position, because you have to remember that in 1975, the majority of Americans did not want to accept refugees from Vietnam, Laos, and Cambodia, despite the very intimate and difficult relationship that the United States had with the region of Southeast Asia. Fast forward 50 years, I would say that the majority of Americans, if they thought about Southeast Asian Americans in the United States, probably generally have pretty positive images of people like us because of our food and our ethnic enclaves and the like. And meanwhile, there are now new people to be afraid of. And this is an old cycle in American history. It is one in which people in the Trump administration have participated in, from Donald Trump to Stephen Miller, who are first and second generation descendants of immigrants from Europe, but who have turned in a very hard way against immigration. Vietnamese people, some of them who came as refugees and were accepted, have now said, we were the good refugees back in 1975, but this time, and this is referring to the first Trump administration, these new people coming from south of the border or people who are Muslims, these are the bad refugees. So the temptation to always create new others and to forget that the others that we had been afraid of were actually not that bad once we got familiar with them, that's, again, an old impulse in American society. It's led to these periodic resurgences of anti-immigrant fear and xenophobia that we can trace very far back in American history, in this case, at least as far back as the phobia against Chinese immigrants in the 19th century that resulted in the Chinese Exclusion Act and eventually the creation of INS, Immigration and Naturalization Service, which is the predecessor to ICE today.
I'd like to shift a little bit to talk about your book, To Save and Destroy, Writing as Another. The book is based on a series of talks you delivered, the Norton Lectures at Harvard, which addressed the question, what does the outsider mean to literary writing? Could you give us begin by giving us a summary of your answer to that question?
The book touches on it's based on the question of otherness, and I think otherness is a universal condition. I'm sure we all have, at one time or another, felt ourselves to be odd or alienated or not fitting in some way. But the difference for certain people is that otherness is constantly imposed on us. That's, for example, conditions of racialization or queerness. These are identities that we don't necessarily choose, although we eventually might, but they are imposed as blanket conditions. And so that dynamic has been evident throughout American literature and culture. I think most of our major artists and writers have probably felt other in some way, sometimes just simply as idiosyncratic or eccentric or weird in some ways that turned them into artists. But we have a significant tradition of writers of color, queer writers, feminist writers, and so on, who have come out of these conditions where they have been marked as part of an entire population. And that condition of otherness is obviously very troubling in a lot of ways, very sometimes disabling, but the friction produced between being an other and looking at the center of power in American culture, looking at the ways by which there are some people and some populations that rest very comfortably in their notions of their own selves, that distance between self and otherness has been enormously productive in producing some of the most powerful and memorable forms of American culture, whether we're speaking of music from black people or whether we're speaking of the literatures of so many populations, from Jewish Americans and now to Asian Americans as well.
If you could also talk about the joy of otherness, as you put it, in the last chapter of your book on the joy of otherness, you write about your experience being a father and conclude by telling the story of your sister to whom your book is dedicated.
I think there's such a range of emotions when it comes to otherness, certainly at its most extreme version, when otherness is used to justify exploitation, domination, and murder. The experiences of otherness can be deeply traumatic and terrifying. Also, again, generative of cultural and psychological responses that are embedded throughout American culture. And other times, otherness can be more moderate and can be embedded in very, very intimate relationships within our own family, for example. I've said in the book that sometimes the other is the one who is closest to us, and perhaps many of us have had that relationship where it's our mother or our father or our siblings who are the ones that are most estranged from us or most confusing or puzzling to us. Now, that can be extremely discomforting, obviously, but sometimes that otherness is also something more gentle. The fact that, for example, I have children who are 5 and 12 years of age, they're sometimes other to me. Sometimes I look at them and I think, who are these strange people that I've given, that I've participated in giving birth to and raising? I love them, but they're also quite different from me as well. And that kind of otherness, there is joy to be found in that, because I honestly did not want to become a father for various reasons, partly because I was afraid of having these new strange others in my life. But those others of my own children have taught me enormous things, most importantly for the purposes of this book, the importance of playfulness. That looking at children who don't know any rules, who do whatever they want, can be frustrating in a lot of ways for parents. But from an artistic perspective, that spirit of playfulness, of childlikeness, is something that we absolutely need to internalize and learn again and again as rule-bound adults. Now, when it comes to my sister, I had a sister. And in 1975, when we fled from Vietnam, we left her behind. And at 4 years of age, I certainly knew I had a sister. But by the time I was 10 or 11, I forgot that I had a sister. And when this letter showed up from Vietnam with a picture of this beautiful young woman, I asked my parents, who is that person? And they said, that's your sister. And that took me by surprise, gave me a shock. And so I grew up from that point onwards aware that there was an other in our family, an absent presence, who I would not see again for another 20 years or so, and who I would not see after that for 20 further years until she came to the United States last year. She timed her visit perfectly. She showed up literally the day before the premiere of my TV series, and I had the opportunity to take her to a Hollywood party where we were the first ones to arrive, and the next person to arrive was one of the stars of the show, Robert Downey Jr., who took photos with us, and I told my sister, this happens all the time for people who come to Hollywood. So after all of the tragedy of our family history, there was joy, I think, in that moment of having my sister arrive for a little bit of the American experience.
In October 2023, you were among more than 750 writers who signed an open letter calling for a ceasefire in Gaza, after which the 92nd Street Y here, 92NY, a major cultural institution in New York City, canceled your speaking engagement there. This led to major turmoil at 92NY, with many staffers resigning in protest. In your book, you address Israel's war on Gaza in the third chapter, titled On Palestine and Asia. And you talk about how you see the opposition to Israel's war on Gaza as comparable to the global protests against the Vietnam War. Can you talk more about that? We interviewed you right at the time you were being canceled here.
That certainly wasn't something that I asked for or wanted. I signed that letter out of an impulse of conscience and conviction. Upon hearing one of the Israeli ministers describe Palestinians as human animals, I knew immediately what that rhetoric was referring to. It's a colonizing and genocidal rhetoric in which an entire population of people are separated from humanity and therefore exposed to the worst that we could do in terms of our so-called civilization. That dynamic has already been well illustrated in books like Joseph Conrad Comrades Heart of Darkness. And so what I think we collectively as a world has witnessed in the case of Israel's occupation of Gaza and of Palestine and what the Israeli military has done since October 7th with the support of the United States is to use that rhetoric of civilization and to use this idea that the West is an overwhelmingly powerful force to inflict tremendous and, I would argue, genocidal violence on a population of people and to kill a vast number of civilians for the most part. So I think it is a situation that for many people outside of Palestine and outside of Israel that we can clearly see that there's a vast disjuncture between the professions of the rhetorical professions of Israel and the United States and what we're actually witnessing from Palestinians themselves. And one way in which this war is comparable to the Vietnam War is that for the world, the Vietnam War became the first television war or the first living room war. People could turn on their TVs at night and literally see images of Vietnamese people being burned by napalm, for example. And this was utterly shocking at that time. And I think there's a similar or parallel degree of shock here when we can see Palestinians using their phones to beam out the images of what it's like to be subjected to mass bombing, random bombing, to see people being blown to bits, including children. It is a shock to the conscience, and it has mobilized a significant degree of global sentiment against Israel and the United States that I don't think we've seen since the 1960s and early 1970s. And the consequences in the United States and elsewhere has been a radical degree of disagreement between those who support Israel and those who are opposed against it, and the mobilization of enormous amounts of political pressure against the people who have been opposed. And this, again, recalls the deep divisions internally within the United States and other countries during the Vietnam War. But I think one difference that's important is that now, under the Trump administration, there's been a weaponization of anti-Semitism, which is a real problem, but a weaponization of anti-Semitism to be directed against anybody who supports Palestine. But even now, under the Trump administration, the weaponization of anti-Semitism in Palestine against anybody that the Trump administration disagrees with.
Yeah, and I wanted to ask you, in terms of Israel, you noted in a recent interview that some research you had done more recently, you discovered that after Jimmy Carter cut off aid to the Salvadoran military government in the late 1970s because of his human rights abuses, that Israel stepped in and supplied the weapons to that Salvadoran military. As much as 83% of El Salvador's weapons were coming from Israel as a favor to the U.S. government.
Yes, that was a shock to me. I have to admit to my own ignorance in this matter that Israel was a key player in Central America, not just El Salvador, but Central America in general in the 1970s and 1980s. I think what had happened is that Israel had built up its military arms industry, obviously, as a consequence of occupying Palestine. Israel became very good at certain things like making weapons and engaging in counterinsurgency strategies against Palestinians and Arabs. And so Israel started to export its weapons. It needed to sustain its own arms industry, and it found Central America, but other places as well, like South Africa, to be good markets for its battle-tested weapons, weapons tested against Palestinians. Israel was also exporting advisors. It was exporting strategies. So, for example, the Guatemalan military turned to Israeli advisors in order to help devise their counterinsurgency strategy against their indigenous populations, which resulted in enormous numbers of deaths, including what has been called a genocide in the early 1980s. So, in some ways, Israel has long been a junior partner to the United States when it comes to military and foreign policy. Places and moments where the United States might not want to be involved very explicitly, Israel has stepped in to supply the weapons and the advisors and the technology and the strategies that the United States might not have wanted to do for themselves.
Viet Thanh Nguyen, we want to thank you so much for being with us. Pulitzer Prize-winning author, professor at the University of Southern California, his latest book, To Save and to Destroy, Writing as an Other. Also co-editor of the new book, The Cleaving, Vietnamese Writers in the Diaspora. We'll link to your op-ed in the Los Angeles Times today. Americans are still learning the wrong lessons from Vietnam. Viet Thanh Nguyen is on a national book tour. He'll be here in New York, in Brooklyn, Thursday night at the Center for Fiction, and at Rizzoli Bookstore in Manhattan on Friday. That does it for our show. Democracy Now! Has job openings. Go to democracynow.org to learn more. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
Is that a normal part of your
singing? That's the way I've always sung. This is my song.
Are there subliminal duets?
Absolutely not.
The Metal Meltdown, a show that brings you melody-driven heavy metal from around the world. Melting your ears every Monday night from 8 to 10 p.m. right here on CJSF 90.1 FM. We'll be right back.